Boom.
If you thought 4 hours a day, 1,200 minutes a week was enough, think again. He's the last remnants of the old republic. A sole bastion of fairness. He treats crackheads in the ghetto gutter the same as the rich pill poppers in the penthouse.
Wow.
The clearinghouse of hot takes break free for something special. The fifth hour with Ben Maller starts right now.
That it is, the fifth hour with Ben Maller, back at it again, a spin-off of the Overnight Show. We are so happy you have found us as we are in the air everywhere. The vast power of iHeart, the global reach of podcasting as we are together again. It is the weekend and we are back at it. Now, this is an interview podcast and there's a couple of things you need to know about this. You're being given a gift here, because this weekend, why is this weekend like most other weekends? Because David Gascon is not here. So you're just stuck with me on this Friday podcast. Now, on Saturday and Sunday, I'll have my trusty sidekick, not Gascon, somebody who's actually good in here. But this particular podcast, it's all about me and the interview and all that stuff. So we'll welcome in a broadcasting friend here in a minute, but a couple of things to take care of. If you have not liked this podcast, please do that. That helps us out. I know it seems ridiculous. It's a pain in the tuchus. I understand that, but 5 stars. If you have some time to write a review, I know you got to come up with a name and all that. That helps us out as well. Positive reviews. Really don't need negative reviews. Positive helps us out. And then cameo.com. If you're on the internet, and which obviously you are, you're listening to a podcast. But if you are a big fan of the show, if you have a relative that's a fan of the show, and you want a video monologue, a Maller monologue just for you, we can do that on Cameo. It's not free, but it's not very much there. On cameo.com, and obviously all of the social media channels. Ben Maller on Twitter. We use that a lot during the weekday radio show on the overnight. Instagram, Ben Maller on Fox, and the Facebook page, which is Ben Maller Show. So I am very excited. I admit it's one of my guilty pleasures. I love talking to broadcasters, especially people that influenced me, that I watched and listened to in my younger days, and we have pulled out of the ethos Mel Proctor. Now, if you're from the Washington, D.C. area, if you're from Baltimore, chances are you are well aware of Mel Proctor, because for years he was the play-by-play voice of the Washington Bullets. That's right. They used to be the Bullets and the Baltimore Orioles. And I most associate Mel with the Orioles. I actually was around him a bit a few years ago. I guess it's been a long time now. But he was the radio guy for the Clippers for several years. And that's where I got to know Mel a little bit. And I had lost track of him. I was like, well, I wonder what Mel Proctor's up to. And for those that have not seen his work, if you're younger, you can actually find some old Oriole games on YouTube. And very entertaining, fun broadcaster, did everything, did network play-by-play, did for basketball, did play-by-play boxing, football. He was all over the place. So let's welcome in now Mel Proctor, joining us here on the fifth hour with Ben Maller. And Mel, thank you for doing this. So I guess I want to talk about you, make this all about you. At least most of it. So how old were you, Mel, when you realized you wanted to be a broadcaster?
Well, when I was growing up, it was the last thing that I thought of. I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player, and was good enough to play in high school and college, but had a little trouble hitting the curveball. So when I graduated from college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I took a real job in Denver for about 6 months. And there was a football player who just retired from the Denver Broncos named Lionel Taylor. And he worked at this company, C.A. Norgren. He was, he kissed babies and shook hands and stuff. And I got to know him, and we both admitted that we missed being in sports and had to get back. And he showed up one day and said, I'd like you to meet the new wide receiver coach for the Los Angeles Rams. And he left for that job. And I thought, well, I got to get out of here somehow. Coat and tie, 7:30 in the morning at work, 2 coffee breaks a day. No, thank you. I can't do this. So Steve Sable of NFL Films had gone to Colorado College where I went to school. I didn't know Steve, but he was several years ahead of me, and some of my fraternity brothers knew Steve. So I started writing letters to his father, Ed Sable, about a job, and they said, there's nothing there. And so I just kept sending stuff anyway, ideas for shows and that kind of thing. And I happened to call one time, talk to a friend of mine who worked there, and I said, I got to come back there for a wedding. Would it be worth stopping by in Philadelphia to see NFL Films? And he goes, yeah, your timing may be perfect. So I went back, talked to Ed Sable, and he hired me. I spent 3.5 years at NFL Films as a writer-producer, still having no thoughts of being a broadcaster. But I got to know a lot of the guys who came in to narrate films, like Pat Summerall and Charlie Jones and Tom Brookshire and those guys. And I heard them talking about the games they'd done that day. And I thought, you know, I would really rather be out of the game somewhere than in a dark editing room or writing a script. So I conned a local radio station into letting me do some high school football. I was a color man at first, and then one day the play-by-play guy called and said, Mel, I can't do the game. I'm sick. I'm going to have to do play-by-play. And I can still to this day remember it. It was the Upper Perkiomen Indians in Pennsylvania against somebody. That was the first game I did, and I said, God, I could do this for a living. So I went from there to doing high school again for a team for a year or so, and sold all the advertising, did everything. And then, to make a long story short, I guess, I went to Hawaii on vacation and fell in love with the place. And I'd written a letter there to a radio station, but never got an answer. So I called the guy, Earl McDaniel, who was general manager of KGMP, and he said, come on over. And we got together for lunch, and he liked me, and he hired me, and so I left for Hawaii, where I spent 5 years, and that's where I really got all my experience. So to answer your question, I never really thought about being a broadcaster until after I got out of college, and the real world kind of hit me.
Yeah, well, it certainly beats having a regular job. I didn't even realize you had worked at NFL Films, and I knew you had done all the different play-by-play stuff, but I loved, growing up, it influenced me as a sports fan, the stuff that NFL Films turned out. And like a lot of guys around my age, we had, before high school football games, to fire up the team, they would put in an NFL Films, season in review documentary. And it was an amazing thing that, you worked there, you were part of it. They would make the most mundane, boring team that was, like a typical 6-10, 5-11, but they would make them seem like gladiators in the NFL Films. What was it like behind the scenes there in those days, putting those videos together?
Oh, it was a great place to work. You didn't have hours. You just showed up and worked when you wanted to on your films, as long as you got the work done. You could work from midnight to 8 a.m. or anytime you wanted, really. So it was perfect, and it just lets you do your own thing. And I got to work, I worked with John Facenda, the great voice of God, who narrated those films, Golden Bay and Green Bay, and I can't do him, but it was funny. All these announcers would come in to narrate the various films, so I got to know them, and some of them were NBA broadcasters who would come into town, and I talked them into letting me be their stat man. So I'd go out to the games with them, like Jack Brickhouse of the Chicago Bulls, and people like that, Van Miller of the Buffalo Bills, or Buffalo Braves. Marty Glickman was a big influence, a guy from New York who was well known. So I got to know all these guys, these broadcasters, top of the line broadcasters, and I thought, God, this is really what I wanted to do. So I was in a good spot to learn from some of the best, and It was a great place to work. It was, the toughest decision I ever had to make was sitting on the back steps at NFL Films, trying to decide whether to stay in this prestigious job in the NFL with great people and creative and fun, and or quit and go full time to a little 5,000-watt radio station in Chester, Pennsylvania, where I could broadcast sports full time. And I took the leap, and it was very difficult at that time.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Ben Maller Show weekdays at 2 a.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific.
How hard was it, you know, Mel, when you networked, obviously worked at NFL Films and you met all these people, but then and to do stats, to go from the stat guy and then you went out to Hawaii and then to get that first big league play-by-play opportunity, how did that work back in those days as opposed to what's going on in the, you know, today?
Well, I was in Hawaii for 5 years and loved it and married a girl from there, from Maui. And, you know, I was pretty sure that I was probably going to stay there, but I wanted to do big league sports, and I was doing minor league baseball for the Hawaii Islanders, which were the Padres' AAA affiliate. And so I'd go to spring training. I got to know their announcers, Jerry Coleman and Bob Chandler and those guys. So I started applying for a few jobs. Well, more than a few, actually. I think I applied to the Houston Astros, went in there and interviewed. The Baltimore Orioles flew me into Oakland for a series because they thought Chuck Thompson was going to retire. Well, he went on for another 30 years. So that job never opened up at that time. And then the Angels talked to me. I came down to the number two guy there. I'd applied for some NBA jobs, and I was getting close to things, but it was so frustrating. Looking back on it, I had no idea how hard it is to advance to that level of broadcasting. But one Sunday, we were sitting out on there, my lanai, having a glass of wine, my wife and I, or wife-to-be, and the phone rang, and it was WTOP in Washington, D.C., they called and asked me if I wanted to be the play-by-play announcer for the Washington Bullets, who had just won the NBA championship. And I said, sure, yeah, let's go. Well, about 2 hours later, I get another phone call from Irv Kays, who was general manager of the San Diego Clippers. And he says, we'd like you to be our play-by-play guy on radio. I said, oh, Jesus, I don't understand this. It's after years of trying, suddenly I get two calls within 24 hours offering me NBA jobs. I said, I'd really rather come to San Diego because it's warmer. And my wife is from Hawaii. I think it'd be an easier adjustment for her. But Irv Kays, who became a good friend, said, I'll be honest with you. He said, the Bulls just won a championship. It's a bigger market. There's more exposure. And to be honest, I'm not sure how long we're going to be in San Diego. So he said, you ought to take the Bullets job. So that's how I got my first big league job.
Wow, that's a wild, wild story. Yeah. And then, you know, I always associate you, because of my age, I associate you with the Orioles, but you were with the Bullets, you in that area back and forth. When you run across people that recall your career, do people associate you more with the Orioles or the Washington Bullets or somebody else?
I think both, really.
Yeah,
because I was in the Baltimore, Washington market for almost 20 years. So, my first year with the Bulls was 78-79. They went to the finals and lost to Seattle after winning the previous year. But that franchise has never made it back to the NBA finals since then. What is that, 42 years or something?
Jeez.
They've never made it back. I happen to be part of it. So that was wonderful.
And they have a new name now, too. They changed their name a number of years ago, so they're no more Bullets anymore.
I was there when they had great teams with Wes Unseld and Elvin Hayes and Bobby Dandridge, and Dick Motta was the coach, and it was a great time to be there. And then, of course, I was with the Orioles and got to see most of Cal Ripken's career, and they had some great teams there. I did that for 14 years. And then came to the cable network I worked for, Home Team Sports, was being sold and everything was up in the air, so I didn't know what I was going to do. But Larry Lucchino, who had run the Orioles, was president of the San Diego Padres, and they offered me a job doing their TV games, and I'd always wanted to live here. So I said, let's go. So we headed to San Diego, thinking I'd be with the Padres forever. It lasted 5 years. Then Larry got pushed out by the owner, John Moores, and everyone that worked for him was out the door, too. So funny how life works sometimes, but.
Yeah, and you've done play by play across. I know you did network stuff. You did some football play by play. Have you done any hockey,
Hockey is the only thing I've never done. I've done boxing for Turner, TNT, and TBS. I did the Goodwill Games boxing. I've done everything except hockey.
Yeah, and I mean, of the sports that you've done, what do you find the easiest and what is the most difficult as a play-by-play guy?
Well, I think the easiest thing that comes easiest for me for some reason and is the most fun is doing NBA basketball on radio by myself, which I did for many years. No color man, just me. And it could get so lost doing it. It's just a wonderful feeling, and I think I had a feel for it because I had played college basketball and kind of sensed the rhythms of the game and developed an unorthodox style of describing things that seemed to sit well with people. And I think that was probably the thing I did best. Baseball is the most difficult because, well, it's every day for one thing. So you have to be around the batting cage and find out what the latest is. It's easier now with all the information. But in those days, you had to really work at it to get fresh information because you can't just keep saying the same thing every day about the same players and same teams. You have to come up with fresh material. And baseball games can get slow. I mean, a 3.5-hour game I still remember a game in Texas when the Rangers beat the Orioles 26-7. It took forever for that game to end. And I don't think I've ever drunk so much beer in my life than after that game. But it answered your question, yeah. I think baseball was the most difficult.
Yeah, and I used to watch you on the satellite doing the Orioles game. You always seemed to have a good time, even when the Orioles had terrible teams occasionally. You seemed like you were enjoying yourself. You weren't taking it too seriously. You had the fun. I felt like you had a pretty good balance of having fun and then calling the game. How did you get to that point, Mel? Because there's like two types. There's guys that have fun. There's guys that are kind of hard-o types that take it way too seriously. I felt like you had a good time. You were having fun doing the games, even when they were terrible.
Well, a couple of things happened. For many years, I think I emulated different broadcasters or tried to steal things from different people and did things to please the people I worked for. And at one point, I realized this is not going to work. This business is so fickle that, you can't please your boss, or you don't know who your boss is going to be next year, or the hell with it. If I can please myself and have some fun, that's all I care about. So that's the attitude I took. I'm just going to go out. I want to have fun. I'm going to try to have as much excitement as I'd experience if I was at a ballpark. And then when I got to Baltimore, they had a crazy ex-player named John Lowenstein who retired, and he became my partner. And John is about the most off-the-wall character I've ever met in my life. And we just hit it off, and it was nonstop laughter after that.
Yeah, that's outstanding. And some of your old games are on YouTube, but I don't know if you ever checked those out. But I occasionally, especially last year during the pandemic, I'd flip on some of the old games, and the random old, mid-'80s Orioles A's game will be on, and you'll be doing the play-by-play. It's pretty cool to check out some of the stuff. But you mentioned getting information, and I think we have a bunch of young guys that listen that want to be they want to follow in your footsteps, guys like yourself that have had big careers and play-by-play and whatnot. But put in perspective, now I can go on Twitter and social media and have content coming out of my ears and my, you know, my nose and my eyes. I mean, it's everywhere. But it wasn't like that. You had to depend on the newspapers and you had to depend on getting information. So kind of walk me through what it was like when you're preparing and you had to get, as you said, new information. How difficult was it to obtain new information on the teams?
Well, that's a good question. It was difficult. I used to carry around like a huge, well, just scrapbook with filled with newspaper clippings and stories taken out of magazines and about different players and teams, and I was constantly updating that, looking for stuff and books and wherever I could find it. It was all in print then, but it wasn't on the internet. There was no internet, as far as I know. And so that's where I had most of the stuff. And some of my broadcast partners used to laugh at me, like the late Mike Flanagan in Baltimore said, "I can't believe you carry all this stuff around." Like this big book full of clippings and stuff that I would refer to from time to time and, you know, pull out a nugget to talk about. And then I just spent a lot of time, too, around the batting cage, in the clubhouse, just, you know, getting to know the players and the manager and so forth, and just working at it. But I always loved the research into things for some reason, which I think is what led me into writing some books.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Ben Maller Show weekdays at 2 a.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. Pacific.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I wanted to talk about that because for those that don't know, Mel, long career as a play-by-play guy, but you've written several books. The one that caught my attention, I'm still in the middle of it, so I have not been able to finish it, but it's a few years old, but Love the Work, Hate the Business is the headline on this, and it's one of the several books that you've written over the years. That really resonated with me because I have a similar perspective, Mel. I am a little younger, but I love working in sports radio. Some of the politics of it, yes. You know, I'm not a big fan of. So kind of, you know, sell me on the book here. Obviously, I'm a fan. I'm a believer in the book. But for those that are considering it, why should somebody buy that book?
Well, I should point out that the book originally came out, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, but I just recently released an audio book where I narrate the book, and I think it's better than the print work because, you know, my voice is there and the emotion of some of the things that I felt. So that's available now from Audible, Amazon, and iTunes for those who want to get it for $9.99. It's a bargain. But, what happened was how this book thing came about. First book I wrote was a book called The Official Fan's Guide to the Fugitive, which is about the old fugitive television show of the 1960s, which was my all-time favorite show. And it was one winter when I had some spare time, and I always wanted to write a book, so I said, I'm going to research this thing, see if I can come up with a book. So when we take road trips, I would try to schedule them with interviewing people who had worked on the show, like Barry Morris, who played Lieutenant Gerard. He lived in Toronto when I was up there for a game. I got together with him and all these different stars that were on the show. I interviewed a lot of them and wrote the book and got it published. So that was the first time. But then what really inspired the book you're talking about was in 2007, I had broadcast for both the Orioles for most of Cal Ripken's career, also for Tony Gwynn's 3,000th hit, last game of his career, which was my last in San Diego. But I went to a bookstore in San Diego, Warwick's well-known bookstore, where Cal Ripken was signing the book. I went down to see Cal and say hello. And I was talking with John Maroon, who was the PR director for the team, and we figured out that I was the only person, not only in the universe, but, you know, the world or anywhere, to have broadcast for both Ripken and Tony Gwynn, and to call Ripken's record-setting game when he broke Lou Gehrig's record and Tony Gwynn's 3,000th hit. And both of them were going in the Hall of Fame that year, 2007. So I paid my own way back to Cooperstown, and I said, I'm just going to experience this. It's a one-in-a-lifetime thing, and I'm going to see if I can write a book about it. So that's how it began. I just kind of went from there and thought, looking back on my career, how much I'd enjoyed it, but I'd started from the beginning and just, you know, give a chronological history of what I'd done, and it turned out to be the book.
Yeah, and you were around Ripken and Gwynn. I was around Tony a little bit, and he was like the coolest star, most, you know, down-to-earth star that I recall being around in those days, because he just seemed to have a really good perspective on everything. What was it like being around him with the Padres in those days?
Oh, he was the best. One of the best human beings that God ever made. Unfortunately, we lost him too early, and you know, but he was so talented, such a wonderful person. One of my favorite Tony Gwynn stories is my son was in high school at the time, and he was playing baseball, and he was in a slump. He wasn't hitting. So Merv Redman was the Padres hitting coach, and I said, Merv, my son's having a little trouble with his hitting. Could you help him out? And he said, sure, bring him in Sunday in the morning before a game, and I'll help him. So I brought my son in. We went down to the batting cages inside the stadium, and Tony Gwynn was already there. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and they had played a late game the night before. And here's Tony working up a sweat in the batting cage, swinging away early in the morning when all of his teammates are probably sound asleep. And I remember saying, I said, Tony, what are you doing here? And they were playing Seattle that night, so he said, I'm trying to figure out a way to hit Randy Johnson, the big unit. He was one of the few guys who gave Tony trouble. But that's how dedicated Tony was to his craft, to be there early in the morning after a night game the night before. And that just showed the kind of person he was. By the way, Merv did help my son get out of a slump. But that always impressed me about Tony.
Yeah, and now you were in with the Orioles for. Were you there when they had that 0-21 start? Were you there that?
Oh yeah.
What do you do as a broadcaster when you're already buried a month into the season? Like how did you handle that? Was it 1988? I think was the year when the team.
Yes.
Yeah. How walk me through what that was like as a broadcaster.
God. It's painful to think back on it, but they were, you know, they were losing in every possible way. It'd be an error here, or a hit batsman with bases loaded, or fan interference, or, I mean, anything you could imagine. They just kept losing and losing. And I remember John Lowenstein, my partner, saying to me, he said, you know, the best thing that could happen to this team is they keep losing, because if they win a game, people are going to stop covering them. But the more they lost, the more the coverage increased. And there were writers and reporters showing up from everywhere, including Japan, I think, to chronicle this team going 0-21 to start this season. It was just unreal. And I can still remember a picture of Billy Ripken leaning on his bat with his forehead on the knob of his bat, and looking just so sad during that time. But it's amazing what happened. They were 0-21, and they came back after finally winning a game, and Larry Lucchino was president of the team, and he had been working with Edward Bennett Williams, who owned the team, and the mayor of Baltimore on an agreement to get a new stadium built. So when the team came back into town, they finally won a game to end the losing streak. They made this dramatic announcement about the new stadium, which turned out to be Camden Yards. So they turned it into an amazing positive. And the next year, in 1989, they came within a few days of winning the American League East.
Yeah, so it was a great turnaround. And that 88 Orioles team, for those that are young and don't, I mean, they had Hall of Famers. Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray was on that
team.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
A young Curt Schilling, who was, you know, not a Hall of Famer, but a very good player.
And Curt Schilling, Brady Anderson.
Yeah. and still 0-21 to start the year. But, Mel, just a word of advice, though. Somebody breaking in right now, what would you say to a young broadcaster who wants to, as I said earlier, follow in your footsteps? What advice would you give him?
Go out and win 20 games or win a Heisman Trophy.
That does help. It is difficult for a guy without, you know, professional experience, right? I mean, it's very, you know, and I deal with the same thing in my, you know, doing sports radio. It's it's a little difficult, but it is also networking, right? I mean, you got to know people, and you did a great thing, as you said. You started at NFL Films, you networked. That's a big part of it too, right? You got to meet people, and usually the people you start out with, the people behind the scenes, end up, you know, moving up, and then they can help you out, right?
Yeah, to some degree. But when I got the Bullets job, I was working in Hawaii, and they used to have a game called the Rainbow Classic, where they bring in teams from all over the country to play, and all of the NBA general managers would use this as an excuse to take a trip to Hawaii so they could party for a week. And so I hung out with these guys and I got to know them. So in the case of the Washington team, Bob Ferry was a general manager. When I heard about this opening in Washington, I called Bob and I said, you know, there's this job. Does it involve play-by-play for the Bullets? And he said, yes. Do you want to do it? And I said, hell yes. I said, all right. So he made a call, and I had a lot to do with my getting hired.
Absolutely. All right. And again, promote the book, Mel, the audio book, and how can people find it? And you said only $10, right? That's a deal. They love the work. Love the work. Hate the Business is the name of it. And again, where can they find it, Mel?
It's at Audible, Amazon, or iTunes.
All right, so wherever you get your audio books, your audio content there. And
or you can go to www.audible.com or
all right.
Amazon, obviously.
Yeah. And what have you been up to, Lee? I mean, I haven't talked to you in a while. I was around you with you doing the Clippers. You actually ended up doing the L.A. Clippers. You did some work with the Clips, and I was around you a little bit then. But what have you been up to recently? You're living in San Diego, right? You're enjoying life. It's a beautiful place to live, wonderful city, the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. I did the Clippers for 3 years, and I probably would have stayed forever, but they weren't paying me much. And so I had a chance to go to Washington to be the first television voice of the Washington Nationals. But it was only a one-year deal because the team had no ownership. They were being run by Major League Baseball. So they could only offer a one-year contract. And looking back on it, it was a mistake. But I took the job and went there and had a ball working with Ron Darling, who went on to have a great career and is a good friend. But that's where things pretty much ended. And so I just, you know, came back here. I wrote another book about Gene Mock, former Major League manager, and did a little of this, a little of that, did some college games for the University of Hawaii and a few other things. But basically, I'm just kicked back now and spending time with my dogs and trying to think of another book to write.
There you go. You got to come up with another book. And when you come up with the book, Mel, we're going to have you back. We're going to sell the book, Mel. We're going to move product for you, Mel, is what we're going to do, okay?
All right. Well, don't forget, we got Official Fans Guide to the Fugitive. I Love the Work, But I Hate the Business, and The Little General, A Baseball Life of Gene Mock, which is very interesting.
Awesome. Hey, Mel, thanks for your time. I appreciate it, and we'll catch up again soon. Thank you.
Ben, anytime. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.